offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is a program we've been doing for more than a couple of years now, and I have the pleasure of having all of your company and to proceed on this beautiful journey with all of you. This is the first episode we are doing in this new time slot. We've been doing it at 7:30 in the evening from this Thursday. This is going to be the new slot in which I will be meeting all of you for this program. So 10 to 11, mark your calendars. On Thursdays, you can join me on the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. And I'm sure most of you would know that there are changes for the other programs as well. After this, of course, you will have Brother Bishu with the Outside Inside Deep Inside segment. And for the afternoon satsang, we will be coming a little earlier in the afternoon today. Instead of 12:30, we will be coming at 12 o'clock. But the duration of the segment will be the same. And thereafter, you will have the Veda Jignasa segment, the Telugu segment, and the afternoon will conclude with the Love to Love program. That's the change in the morning segment, and stay tuned. It'll take a couple of weeks even for us to get used to the schedule, but for those of you who follow the Gita series, from this week onwards, 10 o'clock is the time that you'll have to tune in to catch a fresh episode of this program. We are in the end of another chapter, a very profound chapter, chapter 7. As we've seen before, this is a chapter where Krishna speaks about his own nature. And more importantly, he speaks about that nature being deluded by his own maya, mama maya. As he says, this is my maya, it is my own divine instrument. When Krishna speaks about himself and maya, it makes it a very interesting listen for devotees, because it is in the best interest of the devotees to understand this maya and to go beyond it. As we discussed last week, maya also means a magic trick. And the one who does the trick, a mayavi, the magician, is the Lord himself. And to know the secret behind the trick is literally what we all are trying to achieve. Because the moment the secret behind the trick is known, then the trick no more fools you, right? And the Lord becomes accessible. As always, let's begin with a short summary of what we covered last time, because these verses are, of course, understandably very closely related. So we'll get a better idea of the context in which Krishna is speaking what we are going to discuss today. We covered three verses last time. Verses 23, 24 and 25 of the 7th chapter. Before the 23rd verse, Krishna had spoken about those who worship him and how worshippers of the same Supreme Lord become worshippers of other deities, Anya Devatas, when they seek worldly gains from the Supreme Lord. He had made it very clear that even that devotion is acceptable to him, and he strengthens that faith. It is he who grants what they seek, and eventually he leads them to higher stages. But in the 23rd verse, Krishna says, in spite of this being the fact, the results gained by such worshippers are limited. He referred to those worshippers as alpamedhasam, those of limited intellectual abilities. And even though the Supreme Lord is the bestower of that boon, whatever they seek, since what they seek is material, and that is by nature ephemeral, the gain is also ephemeral by nature and is hence limited. He also made a very important statement where he said, Deva yajaha devan yanti madbhaktaha yanti mamapi. The worshippers of God reach those gods, while those who worship me reach me verily. Though the process is the same, that of worshipping, because he had said, Chaturvidaha bhajante mam. So all of them are worshippers of the same Supreme Lord. So the process is same, that of worship, that of sadhana, that of laboring. But the goal that one sets one's eye on makes all the difference. Krishna had said in an earlier verse that he is the last point in the journey. And those that reach the last point of any journey have no further to reach or no further to go. Whereas all other accomplishments in life are only stages in between. They might be milestones, but they are not the destination. In the 24th verse, Krishna said, "Those who have limited intellect think of him who is unmanifest as being manifest and hence get deluded." We discussed the different angles in which this particular statement can be seen. One from the point of view of the avatar Krishna himself. This statement could be one where Krishna is reminding us that whenever he says, "Me, you come to me, I will give you, I am the supreme, people who worship me reach me." So whenever he makes a reference to himself, it is a reminder that it is not a reference to that divine body whose name is Krishna, but it is a reference to the Supreme Lord who remains unmanifest, even though as an avatar he may manifest once in a while. The other way of looking at it, which is again a profound way of looking at the same statement, is the Lord is always manifest. The Lord is always immanent in the visible universe. It is we who do the mistake of thinking that God manifests only in the form of an avatar, or manifests only when he comes down as an avatar. This is also a sign of Maya. In the 25th verse, Krishna says, "People don't recognize him, people don't recognize him as being the essence of the universe, or especially when he manifests in a form, because of the yoga maya that envelops him. The Lord is always supreme. Even when he takes a physical body, he remains that supreme being. But this yoga maya that envelops this presence is what deludes the devotee from understanding the Lord in his entirety." And we had, of course, discussed about the various connotations of this phrase, yoga maya, what Swami says about it and what other commentators have said about that. He ends that verse by saying, "Because of this yoga maya, his true nature, which is ajam avyayam, birthless and without any decay, is not known to the devotees." And he very interestingly uses the phrase, "na abhijanati." Janati itself means to know. Abhijanati means to know properly or accurately. So na abhijanati, when Krishna said the devotees don't know me, na abhijanati, it means they don't know me properly or entirely. They know. That is why they are devout. That is why they turn to God when in need or when in an emergency. But they don't know the Lord entirely, because when they know the Lord entirely, they will not be deluded and they will not be seeking what they seek. We will continue with that thought in the next verse as well. As I said, this is a very important portion for all of us, because not many people who go through the Bhagavad Gita can speak of this from personal experience. We all have Swami in our lives. We all have the Lord to look up to. We have a relationship with Swami. And these are all verses that help us understand this relationship better, progress in this relationship so that we move closer and higher in our journey, and also observe our own minds and see what is happening when we are praying, when we are interacting internally with our Lord. So we'll go to the next verse. We'll go to the 26th verse. As always, we'll listen to it in the beautiful rendition of Brother Shyam. I'll give you a very brief meaning after that, and then we will discuss in detail what Swami is saying there.
Vedaham samatitani vartamanani charjuna bhavishyani cha bhutani mantu vedana kashchana.
O Arjuna, I know the beings that are gone by, that are present, and are yet to be born, but no one knows me. So that is the 26th verse of the 7th chapter. Till now, Krishna spoke about what happens when people are deluded. The verses leading up to this shloka, after that portion where Krishna described the jnani very briefly, leading up to this shloka, you can say that is verse 20 to 25. Krishna spoke about the other three types of devotees, the arthi, artharthi, and the jignyasu. The portion starting from this shloka, Krishna is going to speak of how to overcome the illusions or the effect of maya that makes one seek trivial things from God. But this shloka as such is a bit more general, and you could say a transition shloka from the previous part and what is going to follow. And also it is a very beautiful standalone shloka as well. As we just saw in the previous shloka, Krishna had said, not all know me as being unborn and imperishable. It is not that nobody knows me. It is not that nobody knows the Lord, but not all know the Lord in that absolute state. And the reason for that is the perspective from where we see. If I were to make a statement of absolute truth, and that statement is going to never change, you can never deny that statement, and that statement is, I will never know Swami. And when I say I will never know Swami, I'm not making a confessional statement or a statement of humility. This statement is true for each one of us. I will never know Swami. This I will and can never know God. Because by nature, this I, this ego sense, is not equipped to know God entirely. And by nature, God is beyond the ken of I. Because that is the relationship between the two, the I and the Lord, the ego and the master. One is the Adhara and the other is the Adheya, the foundation and that which is based on the foundation. Speaking about reason and the ability to know God, Swami would make a beautiful statement, a very fine analogy, so to say. He would say, can you lift the rock you are standing upon? Same is the case with man's attempt to know God through reason. Because the reason itself is based on the Lord, and that which draws its ability to function from the Lord cannot turn towards the Lord and help you show who he is. And that is the relationship between the ego and the Lord. The same concept of relationship between the Adhara and the Adheya, the foundation and that which relies on that foundation, Krishna explains in terms of the ability to know in this particular verse that we just heard. Krishna says, Arjuna, O Arjuna, Veda Aham, I know. Here the word Veda is used in its original meaning, not as the noun Vedas as we use. In fact, the name Vedas itself comes from this root word Ved, to know. So when Krishna says Veda Aham, it means I know Samatitani of the past, Vartamanani of the present, Bhavishyani cha, and the future as well. Bhutani, beings, meaning all beings. So Krishna says, Vedaham samatitani vattamanani cha Arjuna bhavishyani cha bhutani. I know all beings of the past, present and the future. Mam tu vedana kaschana. Mam tu, but me, vedana kaschana. None of them know me. A very beautiful statement. Krishna says, I am standing here as the knower of all beings, past, present and future, but nobody is here who can know me. And when he says know me, it means abhijanati. Nobody knows him in his entire form, right? So why is it that they do not know? Why is it that he is unknowable? Krishna will further explain that in the next shloka. But this gives the image of the relationship between the finite and the infinite. Something similar to the statement Krishna had also made in the beginning of the fourth chapter, if you recall, when he was speaking of him having given this knowledge to Vivasvan, the Lord of the Sun. And Arjuna was surprised to hear that because he thought Krishna is only a few years older to him. And he said, how is it that you know what you were in the past, and how is it that I do not know? Of course, in that context, Krishna had said that I am eternal, Arjuna, so are you. I remember all of that, but you seem to have forgotten it. Why is it that we do not have memory of whatever we have come through, even though it is the same, the subtle body which goes through these many bodies? Why is it that we do not understand? It is because we are filled with what Swami calls Dehabhimanam, body consciousness. We are deluded that this body is who I am. Our view is fixated on this body and this personality, and hence only this life appears to be our only life, and no other memory seems to be accessible to us. But that's a slightly different topic altogether, and I'm sure we must have discussed that in a brief detail when we were going through that shloka in the fourth chapter as well. But here, in this point, Krishna is speaking about his sarvajna aspect, the all-knowing nature of the Lord. Once again, let's just step back a little and look at this in the context of what Krishna is explaining in this particular chapter. As I said, that verse standalone is a very profound and beautiful verse, no doubt. But let's look at it in the context of what Krishna has been explaining in this particular chapter. Krishna is explaining the nature of God, Maya, and our limitations. And he is giving this explanation in the backdrop of prayer and worship, of what we seek from God. What is the relevance or significance of what Krishna is saying here in that context? What is the relevance of saying, I know the past, present, and future beings, but the beings don't know me? This statement, Vedaham Samatitani Vartamanani Cha Arjuna Bhavishyani Cha Bhutani, I think we can see it in two ways, and it's important to see it in those two ways also. One is, I know all beings that are, that have been, and that are going to be, as I just mentioned. The word, in fact, the word Samatitani is a very interesting one. It's actually an emphatic declaration. The word Atitani itself means that which has gone by. So when he says Samatitani, it means each and everything that has gone by. Nothing is lost to my memory, nothing is lost to my knowledge. So one is that Krishna says, I know all beings of past, present, and future. But this is also a statement that suggests, I know the past, present, and future of every being. Isn't it? So the statement means, I know all beings of past, present, and future. I know the past, present, and future of all beings. Both of these ways of looking at the statement is very profound and interesting for us. We are speaking about prayer, desire to be more precise, because desire is what becomes prayer when turned towards God. And based on what that desire is, you are that specific type of a devotee, artha artha tijignasu nani, and as we've seen. And based on what the desire is, you are put in that particular category, and becoming desireless makes you the best form of devotee, a jnani. How does the jnani become desireless? Because he or she acquires jnana, knowledge. And what is that knowledge? The knowledge that I am standing before the Supreme Lord. What is the point of asking for anything worldly? Let me ask only for him. So the one who is in possession of that jnana is called a jnani, and because he has that jnana, his devotion becomes perfect. His or her devotion becomes perfect. Since the jnani has that wisdom, he has become desireless with regards to the world. Now his desire is completely turned only towards the Lord. But this is a clear distinction between a jnani devotee and the other types of devotees. But that is not what we are satisfied with. We want progression. We want a means by which I can become a Jnani devotee. I'm not one right now, but is there a way by which I can get there? And that's what Swami also said, that this journey should be towards that perfection. So how does that perfection come about? When we talk about surrender, it is a change in our understanding altogether, if you look at it that way. Why do we turn to God when in need, or when in fear, or when we want some desire to be satisfied? Well, apart from the fact that we are attached to a certain outcome, and because we want that outcome, we are praying. Praying also is a symbol that we have faith that God can help me get what I want. Faith in the fact that God can favorably influence the future outcome, right? So one is, there is a favorable outcome, and the other is faith that God can bring that outcome for me. And that is the Shraddha that Krishna spoke about a few verses back, and he had said that that same Shraddha I strengthen and I benefit that devotee. But that is what makes us a believer, right? When we say an astika, a believer in God, what is it that you believe in? You believe that there is a God and that God can help me. So somewhere we have that belief or faith in God's omnipotence, in God's power. But in this journey, as we make prayers, as we seek God's help, sometimes he answers and sometimes he doesn't. And anyone who has been a devotee of Swami knows that this is the fact. Sometimes prayers are answered, sometimes prayers are delayed, sometimes prayers are denied as well. But if we hold on long enough to the Lord, I think we all will realize that even when Swami doesn't answer our prayers, it is for a very good reason. Because he knows our past, present and future, as Krishna just mentioned. He knows what is best for each one of us. And we have seen this in so many times. We have seen this so many times with Swami with relation to devotees. Sometimes this would be in a very simple way, when devotees would come to Parthi and they would be desperate to return to their towns. They would book their tickets and they'd want to leave, and Swami will not give them permission. And later they'll get to know that there was some problem in the bus, or the bus met with an accident. Right? We've seen many situations like this. Or there will be a proposal for which you will go to Swami, I want to start this business. Then you will find that had you got into that business, you would have got into deep trouble, and that's why Swami did not give you permission. These are very simplistic ways by which you can understand why, how when Swami denies a prayer too, he can benefit merely because of the fact that he is the knower of the past, present and future. There's a very beautiful instance that Brother Vinay Kumar, who was the former leader of the Karnataka Sai Youth, would narrate, and I'm sure some of you must have heard it in his own narration. In the year 2000, when he was working in a firm in Bangalore, they offered him a very good position in their head office in New York. And that promotion meant that it was a very good step ahead in his career, and he was very delighted with that offer. So in the April of 2000, when Swami was in Vrindavan, he gives a letter to Swami, and in that letter he mentions that, Swami, by your grace I've got this offer, so we are moving to New York, we want your blessings, and Swami's grace should always be on us, and we should be at Swami's service all the while, and so on and so forth. Swami takes the letter from him and literally throws it back at him, and with a very, very displeased expression, Swami says, "Go, leave Swami and go." And Swami just walks away, throwing the letter at him. Brother Vinay just didn't expect this reaction from Swami, and he just could not understand why Swami should be so upset. Because after all, in his view, this is going to be a wonderful move in his career. And after that, Swami would not entertain him, Swami would not speak to him, Swami would avoid him. So he was wondering what went wrong, and you know, why should Swami deny him his blessings for such a good step forward in his life. So this was in 2000, April 2000. September 11, 2001 came, and we all know the event that shook the whole world. The World Trade Center in New York came crashing down, and the office where Brother Vinay was supposed to work in was in the 52nd floor of that very building. a prayer is denied in April 2000, a little more than a year later, he was sitting in front of Swami, overwhelmed with gratitude to Swami for denying that prayer. As Krishna said, with the same Shraddha that you come to me, I will raise you higher. I go to Swami because I have faith in his omnipotence. I want his blessings in a new venture. I want his approval for my choices. And I want him to bless the move that I'm taking. But when an event like this happens, what happens to me as a devotee? Put yourself in Brother Vinay's place and think what would happen to your maturity. The next time I have a prayer, I will go to Swami and say, Swami, this is my prayer, but I don't know what is good for me. You know better than me. You know what is best for me. So I leave it to you. I will accept whatever is your will. Won't that maturity come automatically? So when we make a prayer to Swami and are attached to that prayer, are we not being ignorant to this fact? Or are we not turning away from this truth that he is all-knowing? Many times we do that. We have a prayer in our hand and we go to Swami and say, Swami, you should do this and you should do this for me. Every time we do that, we are forgetting that we are standing before the Lord who knows everything and who knows exactly what has to be done when. This episode I narrated is a very simple or simplistic take on what I'm trying to explain, because you might immediately ask me, what about all those people who really lost their life in that accident, in that terror attack? Why didn't Swami save all of them? That is why I said this statement, Vedaham samatitani vartamanani cha Arjuna bhavishyani cha bhutani, also suggests that not only he knows all beings, but he also knows the past, present and future of all beings. It is easy for me to think of my welfare in terms of the welfare of this body. Swami saved my life. Swami did good for me. Swami saved me from a major accident. Swami did good for me. But Swami also knows the past, present and future of each one of us. This larger journey that we are all going through, he is completely aware of that too. Who knows? Sometimes an accident may be good for us. Sometimes for our larger spiritual journey, it is probably good to undergo certain suffering under Swami's own watch. Who knows? Other than him, who knows best? So if we observe ourselves, our own mind in our journey with Swami, either when we are upset that certain things are not happening in our lives, or we are disturbed with what is happening to people around us, it is because we have forgotten this fact that Swami knows the past, present and the future. And he knows what is good, not just for me, but to each one of them. Every single being in this world. So this shloka is a beautiful description of God as the Adhara, that constant presence, Ajam Avyayam, who is beginningless and beyond decay. All other beings are only brief projections on this constant presence. In that sense, the Lord is the constant witness to all beings coming and going. But in the context of devotion, and we are growing to that ideal state of a jnani in our journey, it is developing this wisdom that Swami is all-knowing. He knows me, not only in this personality, in this body, but he knows me through the many, many forms that I have taken, and hence knows what is best for me. More and more this idea gets crystallized in my understanding. I am moving closer to him. And slowly, in this journey of moving closer to him, this ego sense is also dissolving. True knowledge, as I said in the beginning, can be had only in oneness, only when this I starts dissolving. This I can never stand and say, I know God. When the I steps aside, that is when we really can know God, right? And What do you mean by when the eye steps aside? Is there anybody else other than the eye? Meaning is when the eye goes, there is oneness. So true knowledge only is in that oneness. Just a couple of days, I was speaking to one of our alumni and he was sharing a very interesting conversation between his grandmother and Swami. His grandmother apparently came to Swami sometime in the mid-50s. Apparently, Swami had told her something like giving her a word and that such and such a thing will happen or I will do this for you. I don't know exactly the details of that. And quite a amount of time passed and what Swami had promised, quote unquote, didn't seem to be happening. So one day she kind of confronted Swami. She got up and said, Swami, have you forgotten this? You had told me that this thing will happen. When she said that, apparently Swami literally started laughing and told her, Amma, do you know what will happen to this entire universe if I forget? So don't ever imagine that Swami has forgotten. And what a profound statement. This entire universe will come collapsing if he forgets. It is literally held together through his knowledge and his memory. Because the entire karma system is dependent on that divine memory, isn't it? Our spiritual journey, what Krishna said about what happens to a yoga bhrashta, someone who has labored for many lifetimes to reach a state of a yogi and does a small mistake or has not attained that perfection, he has to come back again in a different body. Imagine the Lord forgets. You have earned so much of good karma all through your many lifetimes. What would happen to us if the Lord forgets? So this entire universe is held together through this divine memory which Krishna is speaking of here. This divine knowledge, I know the past, present and future, and samatitani, not just what has gone by, every bit of what has gone by I am aware of, he says. So when we forget that, we go further into delusion in our relationship with Swami. In the next shloka, Krishna explains why we are not able to hold on to this understanding. I'm speaking about this, but be sure that if put in a situation similar to this, even I'm going to forget that Swami is all-knowing. Some disturbance will start and we forget. It happens to all of us all the time, isn't it? So what is it that causes this? And of course, it is certainly not a new concept for us. We will see that and you'll understand what I mean when I play the next verse. I'll play it. I'll give you a brief meaning of that and then we'll discuss what Krishna says there.
Ichha dvesha samutthena dvandva mohena bharata sarva bhutani sammoham sarge yanti parantapa.
O scion of the Bharata dynasty, O destroyer of foes, due to the delusion of duality arising from likes and dislikes, all creatures become bewildered at the time of their birth. That is the 27th verse of the 7th chapter. As we just discussed, what makes us forget that Swami is all-knowing? Sometimes we would say this in our satsangs in a more light-hearted way. We all have confidence that Swami knows what is best for the entire world. If there is a crisis somewhere, it is, you know, something is happening in some other country, there's a war, there's a pandemic which does not affect us, let's say. There's a disease that's spreading in some other part of the world. It is easy for us to think, Swami knows best, you know. Swami must be doing it for a purpose. But when it comes to my problems, I start acting as though Swami has no clue what to do and I need to tell him precisely and give him an idea what is good for me. We chant Samasta Loka Sukhino Bhavantu and say, Swami, you know what is best for this world, so take care, I'm making a prayer for that. But when it comes to my personal needs, I will specifically tell Swami, you know, this year my daughter should get married, Swami, I should get this medical seat, Swami, I should get this visa in this particular year. When it comes to our needs, we become more specific and precise. Why is it so difficult when it comes to our own needs to remember that Swami knows what is best and I don't need to really ask? And this thinking is precisely the difference between a mature devotee and the rest of us, isn't it? It is because of what we call attachments. When it comes to our own affairs, be it personal or relating to the family or related to our career and work, we are so attached to what we like and dislike, isn't it? When it is with regards to someone else, our involvement in that problem is far lesser. And so it is easier for me to just make a prayer and let go. This is nothing new or beyond our experience. I think you just have to observe your own mind to understand this is what happens with each one of us. Someone comes and tells me that so-and-so, a certain acquaintance has tested positive for corona. The next day when I'm praying or when I'm standing before Ganesha, I might think of that person for a little and say, you know, Swami, please take care of this person. And then I'll say, Swami, anyway, you know what is best for that person, you'll take care. But if someone who is close to me, my own family, and I hear that that person is sick or that person is infected, the prayer will be quite different, isn't it? I will not say, Swami, you know, whatever is to be done. I'll say, no, Swami, please take care of that person. I mean, of course, if the devotee is very mature, the prayer will be different. But the rest of us, the involvement in the prayer will be quite different. And that is because our likes and dislikes become more rigid when it comes to attachment or when it comes to people or events we are attached to. And it is that attachment which is the cause of our birth itself, isn't it? Because there are some unfulfilled desires, because there are some specific give and take with certain people whom we have got attached to, we have got involved with. And all of that makes us come into this personality. And that is what leads us to be born the way we are born. And that is precisely what Krishna says in the shloka. He says, Bharata, O Bharata Arjuna, Icha Dvesha Samuthena. Arising from Icha and Dvesha. Icha is another word for likes. And Icha Dvesha Samuthena. Arising out of likes and dislikes. Dvandva Mohena. By the delusion of the pairs of opposites. Sammoham Sarge Yanti Parantapa. O Parantapa, the scorcher of enemies, Sammoham Yanti, are subject to delusion, Sarge, at the time of birth. If you recall, Krishna had said in the third chapter that each one has a prakriti, a nature that they are born with, and that prakriti propels them to act. And that manifests in the conscious mind as raga and dvesha with regards to the senses. Raga and dvesha, we have heard these two words so many times in the series, and at one point I also mentioned, Swami says, man is not being ruled by the Navagrahas, he is being ruled only by two grahas, and the two grahas are raga and dvesha. There are some things that you like, some things you don't. And that is what we refer to as raga and dvesha. And karma yoga, or doing one's dharma without attachment, was given as a solution to that in one of the very early chapters in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna emphasizes that very point again here. That when you have raga and dvesha, you will not be in a position to understand or remember that Swami knows what is best. I'm sure I must have mentioned this earlier as well. Raga and dvesha are words with a wide range of meaning. In the truest sense, they mean attachment and hatred. As you can see, these are the far ends of the ideas of likes and dislikes. What you like too much, you get attached to. What you dislike so strongly, you start developing a hatred for. So raga and dvesha represent this entire gamut of meaning, from likes to attachment, from dislikes to hatred. So when under the influences of something so intense, attachment and hatred, even though you stand in front of the Lord, even though you have this input that the Lord is all-knowing, you might even have experience in the past where Swami has shown that He knows the past, present and future and what is right for you. But at that moment when we are attached, at that moment when we have a strong like and dislike, we tend to forget this nature of the Lord. But this is at the point of prayer. But in a more fundamental sense, these likes and dislikes only lead us to do karma, right? It only makes us do certain activity, then it eventually solidifies into our character, which become a part of our subconscious mind, and then manifests as our prakriti or nature at the time of birth. And this causes us to be born deluded, right? Why are we born deluded? Why are we not born with the knowledge of who we really are? Because of this entire process that I just mentioned. In the next verse, Krishna explains who is able to break this pattern, but we will come to that in a short while when we discuss that verse. Though we all are under the influence of our likes and dislikes, it is also true that we have not completely become subservient to the likes and dislikes as well. We still follow some decorum in life, don't we? We have some discipline or the other. And you cannot follow discipline without controlling to a certain extent your likes and dislikes. Every time I say, I think I've had enough, when I'm sitting at a meal, there's my favorite food in front of me and I say, I'm good, thank you, I am overcoming the craving of the tongue, which means I have resisted raga and dvesha. And I feel matches going on, but you say, no, I have to go for bhajans, that is more important. You're overcoming raga and dvesha, isn't it? So without that control, you are not even ready for spirituality. That is why Krishna says in one of the, Swami says in one of the discourses about Arjuna, that Arjuna had kept raga and dvesha under control as much as it was possible for him. And Krishna felt that Arjuna, with such great qualities and qualifications, would help build a better world, and therefore he taught Bhagavad Gita at great length to him. So when Krishna is saying this to Arjuna, it does not mean that Arjuna did not have control over raga and dvesha. In fact, he had a certain amount of control over raga and dvesha. He is known to have been leading a disciplined life. That is how the character of Arjuna is described in the Mahabharata, and that is what in a sense qualifies him to receive this understanding of this discourse that Krishna is giving. So that is why Swami would often say that a disciplined life, niyamas, nishta niyama, Swami would say, there should be a certain amount of regulation in the way we lead life. And this regulation is what will take us to that ultimate state where we are completely beyond raga and dvesha. Right now, if you recall, in the third chapter, Krishna said that you should not become vasham or become completely enslaved by raga and dvesha, right? From that state to the point where there is no raga and dvesha at all and the maya is completely gone is the entire journey, right? And that is why Krishna says, I'm sorry, Swami says in that discourse that Arjuna did have control over raga and dvesha, and that is what qualified him to receive this discourse. And the similar way out, as Krishna had promised in the third chapter for raga and dvesha, he is going to give here in the next verse as well. So we'll listen to it. This is the 28th verse, and we will discuss about it and conclude with that for today.
Yeshan twantagatam papam jananam punya karmanam te dvanda moha nirmuktaha bhajante maam dridhavrataha.
But those men of virtuous deeds whose sins have come to an end, they, being free from delusion of the pairs of opposites, worship me with firm resolve. What Krishna says here is very important and a reiteration of what he had indicated earlier in the chapter about, in this chapter itself, when he said Sukritina, the doers of good deeds. This prakriti that deludes, as we saw, is not on God. This yoga maya which we are talking to, it is not on God. It is actually in my mind, isn't it? Because the control point is within me and not outside. To look beyond Maya and see the Lord's Swarupa, I don't have to change something in God. I have to change something within me. So the source for Maya is within me and within you. And what is it that this source is made of? It is made of the three gunas. And among this, when we talk of a samsari or a worldly person, the guna of rajas is more predominant. In fact, one is under the grasp of this guna of rajas because the samsari's mind is always restless. It sees the luxury in it once. It sees a worldly success in it once. It sees name and fame and it craves for that. So when it sees these various aspects of the world, it is attracted to it. It is disturbed by it. It is unsettled by it. And that is the very nature of rajas. So the samsari's mind predominantly is governed by rajas. And then in the third chapter, Krishna had mentioned this. He said, to be more precise, in the 37th verse, in reply to Arjuna's question, when Arjuna asked what makes a person sin, why is it that a person makes mistakes and does wrong deeds? He had said, kama esha krodha esha rajoguna samudbhavaha mahashano mahapapma vidhi yenam miha vairinam. This desire, this anger born of the quality of rajas is a great devourer, a great sinner. Know this to be the enemy here. It is this quality of rajas that needs to be tackled. And for that, the sattva component of the mind must be raised. And that can be achieved only by doing more good karma or punya karma, sacred actions. And this process of doing sacred karmas itself tackles this raga and dvesha, isn't it? When I control my impulse to take revenge, when I control my desire to hurt someone with my words, when I rein in my selfishness, all this makes me master my likes and dislikes, raga and dvesha. And that is what Krishna mentions here. He says, tu, but, he's contrasting with the person he spoke about in the previous verse, yesham, for those, jananam punya karmanam, men of punya karmas or performers of sacred actions, papam antagatam, sins have come to an end, they, dvandva moham nirmuktaha, freed from the delusion of the pairs of opposites, bhajante mam, worship me, dridavritaha, having become firm in their conviction. As the heart gets purified, one automatically turns towards God. And this turning to God is actually beyond our idea of believer, non-believer, you know, an agnostic, skeptic, and all of those descriptions that we give. And one eventually reaches a state where one is in a state of constant worship, and this worship cannot be qualified as bhajan, archana, puja, and all of that. In fact, Swami explains this in one of the discourses that he gave, one of the Gita discourses that he gave in the year 1986. Swami says, and I'd just like to quote that entire passage, the very profound thing that Swami says in that discourse. He says, and I quote, when you keep a beautiful rose flower in your hand, it spreads its fragrance to you and others around. The fragrance of the rose is the same, whether it is kept in the right hand or the left hand. You may have a distinction of right and left, but the fragrance has no such distinction. Similarly, in God's view, there is nothing like an astika, theist, or one who believes in the existence of God, or nastika, an atheist. You may entertain such distinction, but God does not. Even a nastika who does good to others is dear to him. The Gitacharya declares that whoever has controlled his raga and dvesha is most dear to him. The secret underlying the three concepts of Astika, Nastika and Astika Nastika is the nature of their qualities alone. Beyond these three, there is another type of person, namely Yastika. An Astika is one who has self-confidence. Nastika is one who does not have such self-confidence. An Astika Nastika is one who becomes an Astika in times of difficulties and remains an Astika at other times. A Yastika is like Prahallada, who has an inborn trait of devotion to God and who leads a pure and sacred life throughout. He is not influenced by either somebody's teaching or compulsion, but his inherent nature of devotion. He could have a vision of God because he has been experiencing the indwelling divinity at all times, in all circumstances. He could enjoy that divine bliss. End of quote. Swami interestingly says in that passage, if you noticed, Astika is one who has self-confidence. He does not even say Astika is one who has faith in God. He says Astika is one who has self-confidence, because having faith in God is nothing but having confidence in the self. And from that passage, we all can look at ourselves and see where we fall in that categorization that Swami gave. We all fall into that category of Astika Nastika, isn't it? We turn to God when in need. And more than when in need, and more the need, the more our faith goes up. And this faith goes up and down. And that's why Swami clearly said that one is an Astika Nastika. The goal, of course, is, as Swami said, to become Yastika, where eventually one is born with this only desire to worship God, right? As Krishna said in that verse, one becomes a person who worships the Lord with absolute perfect conviction, dridavrataha. And that happens when this raga and dvesha is completely overcome. As Krishna says in this verse, that can be reached only through good and sacred actions. Swami had started this entire chapter with that, right? When Krishna spoke about those who eventually turn to God. What makes a person turn to God? He said, sukritinaha, dushkritinaha and sukritinaha. He said, those who give themselves up to wrong actions get further deluded. Those who have led disciplined lives, those who have led righteous and moral lives, will eventually turn to the Lord. And when they turn to the Lord, why do they turn to the Lord? Because they have desires, they do not have the option of taking the wrong path. So they turn to God to secure what is right. Right? I'm not talking of those people who give themselves up to all kinds of wrong actions and also turn to God. We are talking about true devotees here, and Krishna has qualified that by saying only those whose actions have become pure can be called devotees. And after having turned to God, you still have raga and dvesha, and that is what takes the form of prayer. And as Krishna beautifully described, through that same Shraddha, because of that Shraddha you turn to God, he says sometimes he answers, sometimes he doesn't answer. As we saw, there is a beautiful dual meaning word that he had used, hita. Hita means welfare. Or it could be he tan. Whatever you pray, he gives, or he gives what is best for you. And in that process, he gives this understanding, and we transition from this faith in God's omnipotence to God's omniscience. Not necessarily we'll stop making prayers. We will certainly make prayers, because as long as there are desires within, there will be needs, there will be something that we will be attached to. But when we turn to the Lord, we will make a prayer, and there will be the remembrance or this memory that the Lord is all-knowing. And when we make that prayer, there will be detachment in the prayer itself. Swami, in my limited understanding, this is what is good for me. This is what I need. This is what I feel should happen in my life. But you are all knowing. You know what is best for me. And I leave it up to you to do what is right for me. Right? And that journey is what we are talking of, that the Lord is leading to. And that is why this chapter is a very, very beautiful chapter. It's a very small chapter, but nevertheless, it is very relevant to each one of us, because I'm sure in some level we all categorize or consider ourselves to be devotees. You're not wrong in doing that. But very interestingly, Krishna used the word bhajante mam instead of bhaktaha. Bhajante means those who worship. Being devoted is different from being worshipper of God, right? When you worship God for any other benefit from the world, as Swami beautifully described, you're actually devoted to the world, but you're turning to the God, turning to the Lord to have those desires satisfied. Slowly in this process, we will become devotees of the Lord Himself. There are two more verses in this chapter, and I think with that we will complete this chapter. And as we've been following in all the chapters, after we complete this chapter, we'll also have a short summary, but that'll have to wait for the next few weeks. Thank you, dear listeners, for joining me. There's a very beautiful story or episode, and those who are regular listeners of Radio Sai will be aware of it. I'll probably start next week with that story. I wanted to narrate it this week, but I think I have too less time to start with that. We'll probably start with that, with what happens when a devotee attains this maturity. And this maturity can come only out of love, right? It cannot come purely as an intellectual understanding. When you say that you should know God is all-knowing, it cannot come as a pure intellectual understanding. It comes only when there is immense pure love at the lotus feet, right? So I'll start with the experience of a small devotee next week in this context, and then we will proceed with the rest of the verses and complete this verse. So thank you, dear listeners, for joining me. Do join me again next week at the same time, that's 10 a.m. in the morning of Thursday, for the resumption of the Triune Pilgrimage. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the segment Outside, Inside, Deep Inside. That'll be from 11 to 12. At 12 noon, I will join you with Brother Arvind for the afternoon satsang. Later in the day, we have the bhajan tutor. That'll be after evening bhajans, 6:45 to 7:30. 7:30 to 8:30, we are resuming our video satsang series. So this week we have a satsang by Brother Bishu and Brother Amai, a very interesting one. I'm sure by now some of you would have read the topic. The topic is an explanation of the Rudram, or how you can connect to the Lord through Rudram. It's very interesting. I don't have to tell you that. For those of you who want to catch, that is also going to be premiered on our YouTube channel. So if you are more interested in watching the satsang, that's where you'll have to go. You'll have to go to our YouTube channel, or you can go to the Sri Satya Sai Baba Facebook page. So till I meet you all next week, 10 a.m. on Thursday, keep well, take care, Jai Sai Ram.